I'm very happy to welcome Earl Kessler. He's author of the book Letters from Alfonso, Learning to Listen. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is a book that starts with your experience in the Peace Corps. You were an architecture student. You went to the Peace Corps basically to help the world,
correct,
idealism, you know, build houses. What were your hopes and dreams when you first went?
Well, it was really to be engaged in the social change activities that were going on at the time. What we were taught in architecture school was something that was really out of phase with the mid-60s when I was in Washington University in St. Louis, where we were given design problems that were related to mega garages, and all we wanted to do was social housing. And so I, with a great deal of luck, managed to graduate from Washington University, and I went to Columbia, and that's where my whole life changed.
So the nation of Columbia.
The nation of Columbia.
And you found yourself in a really small village there near Cartagena.
Well, I had two experiences. One is when we first arrived to Cartagena, when we first arrived to Colombia, we flew over the interior, and it was sort of like the old Peace Corps days where they pushed you out of the plane, and you parachuted into your site, and you began to do your work.
Did they do that?
Not really.
Okay.
But it was almost the same, because essentially you were told you had studied Sal Alinsky in your training here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We were the last of the outward bound groups that trained there. And we went in to work with our communities, and it was to be innovative, to look and to understand felt needs. And that's what we really started with. That's where the whole community development movement really took us. And then I went to Cartagena on my third year. And by that time, I was a proficient Spanish speaker. Being in the interior of Colombia, they speak quite slowly. And so I was able to really get my Spanish up really quite well. And then you hit the coast, and it's coastal Caribbean Spanish, just like Puerto Rico or Cuban, and it's clipped in really fast. And my colleagues who were sent there to begin with really had a disadvantage because it was very hard for them to learn the language in that kind of an environment.
You write a little bit about the history of African South Americans, Afro-Colombians, and Cartagena had a sort of interesting history of kind of being left alone. You call it benign neglect.
Right, exactly. Cartagena actually was the gateway to slavery into the Andean region. It was where the ships came in and they docked and they unloaded their cargoes. The slaves were not happy to be in that particular situation, and so the Cimarron communities, a Cimarron is a runaway slave, they ran away far enough outside of the city of Cartagena to set up in what they call palenques or stockades. And they developed a language. And the language that I was really exposed to was a language that was a 17th century Portuguese-Spanish mix with African words in it. I mean, it was really quite amazing. And I managed to communicate. And so that was, I was really quite sure that my communication skills were up to snuff, so that when I finally got around to beginning to work with this community and we had this experience of developing this plan for this new town, after I drew up my little plan, trying to get input from the community, it became really clear that I had missed the boat.
Let's talk about that. I mean, the subtitle of your book is Learning to Listen, and learning to listen is a much deeper and longer-term process and a much more personally profound process than a lot of people actually engage in.
Exactly. And that's one of the key issues that it set me on when I began to do my development work, was because of that experience with Puerto Badel. And it revolved around the design of this new town. And I kept asking my colleague Alfonso, who was the community leader, and those are the letters that are referred to here in the book. They were letters from Alfonso about the progress of the community. But we only got there after I had drawn up this little plan, because they said, no, you're the gringo, you know, you come down to help us, and so you know what to do. And so I said, well, fine, you know, I'm a recently graduated architect, I can design. And so I sat down and I designed this little community, and I went to the community, and as I said, my Spanish was really pretty good, so after my presentation and I had finished, there was complete silence. I said, uh-oh, what happened? And so it was, okay, Alfonso, what's the deal? And he stood up and he says, and I became Carlos, because they can't say Earl. The
right
sound in Spanish doesn't come through. So they barked at me for a while. They said, I answer to a lot of things, but don't bark. Give me a name. So I became Carlos. And he says, Don Carlos, This is a really a good plan. We think it's a good plan. In fact, we're sure it's a good plan where you're from. But what we really need is this and this and this and this. And I said, Alfonso, I've been asking you for months to give me those kinds of inputs. Why? What was the problem? Why wouldn't you do that? And he looked at me and he said, well, we didn't think you'd listen. And so that was the beginning of how I understood what you needed to really do to engage, that you had to avoid being prescriptive. You had to really be participatory. And that what I took with me from that experience into my future career, which lasted now 45 years, has been that kind of an orientation, much to the chagrin of some of the groups that I've had to work with, because they're all prescriptive and they have their agenda and they go into communities and they tell them what to do and what they can sell them, and that's what they do, and it doesn't work. So that's what this book is really about, is to how to get groups that think they're helping to actually learn how to help.
Which is tricky, because there are so many psychological things like colonialism, and I mean, even the, I mean, it works from both sides. I mean, they said, oh, you're the gringo, you must know. So there's that attitude of giving you power.
Mm-hmm.
And then their attitude of thinking that you won't listen, and then the gringos or whoever they are, people who come in from the outside doing development, thinking we know everything.
What was really interesting is at the time, the Peace Corps was engaged at a period of time when within the Catholic Church there was a whole movement of liberation theology. And the liberation theology movement really had decided that poverty was a sin. And the Peace Corps in many ways was a secular version of the liberation theology. We went into the communities thinking about how to improve, expand opportunities, and to really provide support to those communities. What we really also learned and became really critical later on was that as soon as you approach a community, you create expectation. And in creating expectation, you have to really be able to follow through with it in a very short period of time, because you're talking about people who live on the edge. You're talking about people in a poverty state who don't have all of this time for participatory practice and all this theory that comes out of universities and an agenda where, you know, you get them to sit down with you. Well, if they don't have time to sit down with you because they're barely scraping by, then you have to be prepared. And we at that time, these were the Camelot years of the Peace Corps, I call them, because it was where you were provided with carte blanche management of resources. And that meant financial, material, and social resources. And we were able to go into communities, create an expectation that then brought the people together to be able to do all the self-help and mutual aid work that communities were capable of doing. And then for us to follow through and provide the small amounts of cash to buy the tin sheets for a roof. And being in an architect's group in the Peace Corps, we had the luxury, and I call it a luxury, of having a product. Ours was not that it was a social movement and we were going to discuss things and try to create demand and all. We had a product that we could actually, at the end, could give you a result. And having the result was very satisfying. It was very satisfying.
What were the things that the community wanted that you had not anticipated in their buildings?
Well, first of all, scale. I didn't understand what a rural community was really engaged in, how they earned their livings, what they used the land for. And so the size of the lots that I had prescribed were urban lots. And the first thing that Alfonso told me was that what we really need is we need a lot of 15 by 30, and I had 7 by 20 or whatever it was. But it was quite a considerable distance. And because they used their lot for truck farming, and they would plant a few things for their own use and cultivating vegetables and fruit trees. This is the tropics, right? And so you drop a seed on the ground and everything grows. And so they were able to augment their own diets and create a better and improve their diet, because essentially they were rice farmers, or they worked on cattle, the cattle ranches around them, or they went out fishing, or they had to migrate. The men had to migrate to Venezuela to earn a job, to get a job, to earn money to bring it back. And so there was this floating population of people in and out of this community. And it was really, really subsistence.
We're talking to Earl Kessler about his book, Letters from Alfonso, Learning to Listen. Now, Alfonso is a really interesting character. He's a community leader whom you've now had a many decades-long friendship with. And he was also, I mean, he's one of these people who was living on the edge, just barely getting by, but also had the position of being a community leader, and at one point tried to quit, and the community wouldn't let him. But doing that kind of leadership and making a living is really hard.
It's extremely difficult. What Alfonso really brought to the table was his vision. He was someone who could see that what was needed was that he had to create a future in the Pueblo, and that his whole orientation was to try to be able to do that. And so it was the initiation of the description and development of services, elementary schools. The population was more or less illiterate when we first started. They now have a secondary school in the place. Puerto Badel not only exists on a map, because when I went back one time, I went to the Agustin Codazzi, which is the mapping agency of Colombia, and there on the wall was this huge map of the state of Bolivar in which Cartagena and Puerto Badel exist. And there on the map was this dot with Puerto Badel.
Which made your heart go pitter-pat.
It did. It really did. But they were able, and what's really interesting is the whole idea and the notion of developing a local economy, which is another one of the aspects of things. You have to think in terms, and what I learned from this experience was you have to think in a very integrated manner. It's not just that you provide a single function or a single service. You can't just provide a house, because the house will not prosper if there's not the other aspects of a village life there. And that's really what they were able to accomplish, and they were able to do so because they had a consistent support system over 40 years that came from the Catholic Church. There was a mission at the head of the Canal del Dique, which is this waterway that was sort of excavated by slaves in the 1700s to connect the city of Cartagena to the Magdalena River that then connected to the interior of the country, because the coast was very treacherous. It had too many reefs, and the boats crashed all the time. And so the mission really worked with the communities and gave them that consistent amount of support that's necessary. Generally, support comes into communities that's very lumpy, big, huge amounts at the beginning. And it's unnecessary because the families and the people can't use it all at the same time. They really need to have incremental assistance spread out over a period of time so that the ideas of the incremental support supports the incremental growth of the town itself. And that's the other real big lesson that comes from this.
Right. And there are so many debacles in this world, from Haiti to Afghanistan. I mean, almost any place you look where there's large amounts of development aid, there are the kind of problems that you have precisely from not learning to listen and not making long-term commitments in a community.
Absolutely. Later on, after I had my career with USAID, Shari and I moved back to Bangkok. We lived in Asia for 15 years. We lived in Latin America for 15 years. And the last period was with the Asian Disaster Preparedness Center. And during that period of time, the tsunami hit. And the tsunami, the world responded in a very generous way. However, the agencies that received the resources were drowned in monies. And the monies came in ways that were really inappropriately used. Development assistance has very funny categories. There's a relief category that has a time frame that's totally inappropriate to it. 6 months, relief is over. And then you move into reconstruction and recovery. Well, if you can't transfer the monies from the relief into the recovery, everybody's running around like crazy trying to disperse monies. Nobody wants to return it.
Right.
And so you have this problem, and it was the Doctors Without Borders embarrassed the entire NGO world by actually returning money because they couldn't use it wisely. And what I call drive-by assistance is what happened during the tsunami. You could sit there and these big, huge SUVs loaded with experts and technicians would drive through communities, and on the side of the road there'd be this despondent victim of the tsunami, and they would yell out the window because they would never stop long enough to talk to them, "What do you need?" And he would go, "I need a house." And they'd throw a house out the window. Imagine it.
Basically.
And then he would sit down again, and another SUV would come behind because they were also over-endowed with resources. "And what do you need?" "Oh, I need a boat." Boom! A boat would come out the window. The same thing happened in Haiti. Everybody arrived in Haiti. I was part of the shelter team in Haiti in the reconstruction. And people came in, and they had an agenda. And there's an awful term which characterizes much of what some of the donor organizations do, which... And it's sort of signature projects. A signature project is a project that you put your billboard on, and it says, "So-and-so built this community, blah, blah, blah." And then you can go back to your constituents, and you can say, "See, this is what we did. These are the results we have." And they really distort the entire process. Because especially in Haiti, where if you started and all you had to do was arrive to see that the first priority was getting rid of the rubble. The rubble was a huge problem, and most of the agencies avoided it because it wasn't, quote, sexy. And so what did they do? They then decided they were going to go and do a lot of the permanent housing kinds of things. Land tenure is a big problem. It gets into very technical discussions about what is possible and what's not possible. But the one really problem for me, one of the most successful projects, is a place called Ravine Pintad, which actually was run by groups that I knew that actually had listened. And they went in and they talked to the people. And they, from vulnerabilities, they created assets because they understood that if the people weren't able to develop the site itself, protect the site itself, any kind of structure they put on it, because they were going to stay there, was going to slide down the hill.
Right.
And so site development became part of the agenda. And that's only, you only know that if you listen to the community when you're speaking to them.
One of the things that I thought was interesting is that people in Colombia and Puerto Varela, where you were at one point reluctant to use poor man's materials and wanted to use concrete block. And I've traveled through Latin America and seen so many hideous, horrible concrete block buildings that are super hot when it's hot and super cold when it's cold, but those materials conferred a kind of status.
That's right. And what's really interesting about it, some of the work that we did when I was in Ecuador was to work with groups that were dealing with bamboo. And bamboo is the consummate poor man's material. It looks shabby, it's awful, and it's employed really badly. But I worked very fortunate. I've been fortunate in my professional career to have really very, very competent partners in what we were doing. And this gentleman, Jorge Moran, down in Guayaquil, he and I set up a bamboo and studies workshop. And from it, we began to develop this new approach to use bamboo in a contemporary way that changed its visibility completely. It changed its status. And then all of a sudden, into the Dusseldorf World Fair, a Colombian architect built this huge bamboo exhibit. And the Germans went nuts. They said, hey, you can't, it's a fire hazard, it's a this, it's a, and the guy said, want to bet? And so he invited them. They built another one in Colombia to demonstrate to the Germans that, in fact, it was a legitimate, up to code, up to standard, and it really changed the whole perception of what the material is. This business that everybody has to have a concrete block house is really what the problem in Haiti was all about. People who I knew in Haiti told me that that the earthquake really was a construction disaster made worse by an earthquake. Because in the people's use of materials, the concrete blocks, the slabs, the reinforcing rods, they were all underdimensioned and they were all poorly constructed. And they thought, well, if I just don't add so much cement, it'll still be okay. Well, not okay, because who thought there was going to be an earthquake, right? And then the earthquake came, and that's what collapsed.
So how did you engage in dialogue about materials with your community there in Colombia?
Well, one of the things that we were trying to do is we were trying to demonstrate that there are ways of improving the local building materials. And there was a block-making machine that was developed in Bogotá in Simba. It was called the Centro Investigaciones something de Vivienda. And it was a soil cement block-making machine where if you put some 10% cement into the soil mix and you compress it, you can do these manually. You can make your own blocks, and they become really resilient. And so it began that the community really took to that. And in fact, it was the women who mostly took over because, first of all, they were able to manage the machine themselves. The men were off in the fields or out and tending cattle or whatever. And they were there really building a lot of the work. And the women in Puerto Varela are very strong, very competent group of people who took on the responsibilities for a house. Much of the house construction was done by them. And so it was to improve and talk to them about the use of materials that they could do.
What is the community like now?
Ah, the community is actually quite amazing. What happened, and once again, I think they were really quite fortunate, is that in next to the community, some large company decided to invest in shrimp farming. And so while shrimp farming is sort of a tenuous economic activity because ultimately it poisons the soils around it just by the very nature of what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, as you write, it only lasts about 5 years, and then they have to move someplace else.
Exactly. And so what it did, however, it provided a consistent employment to the community. And that gave the people in Puerto Varela the notion that they had a future, because they took those resources and they invested them in their housing. And they really improved the housing. And you go into Puerto Varela right now and they have, you know, metal fencing and they have fancy windows and they have all, I mean, and it's really just, it's such a pleasure to go there. However, what it did and what happens now is that they've evolved into the next phase of their development predicament. How do you, you've exited your subsistence existence, and now you have to find what is it that you need to do to be able to continue to prosper and grow. Well, with the high school that's there, the children don't have to leave, because normally what would have happened if they got out of elementary school, they would have to go out of the village and live with a family member someplace in another town or in Cartagena or in some places like that to continue their education. They don't have to do that now. And what my hope is that they're able to expand, and someone will be there to work with them to devise and develop new economic strategies, which are the issues that the village has to really confront right now to bring its future out and make it really prosper.
Earl Kessler is author of the book Letters from Alfonso, Learning to Listen. If you could train world banks and NGOs and aid organizations and so on to do this process of development in a way that was more successful, what are the kind of top points that you would teach?
One of the top points is really the amount of time dedicated to accomplishing the results that are expected. When I worked for USAID, it was a joke that every project paper that you designed, that you created, you wrote, if it was longer than 3 years, it was disapproved. And so therefore, guess what? Every project was going to be accomplished within a three-year period, knowing full well that, in fact, it wouldn't. And the same thing with the bank. The
but
bank
why
is
did
a bank.
They do that? Why did they...
Because they really don't have experience on the ground, and they have a great deal of pressure within for results. And so it becomes political as opposed to developmental. And within the bureaucracies in which they exist, if they're not able to manage up and show them what their results are, who has enough time? I was involved in a project in India where we put a considerable amount of money into this water supply in a town of Tiruppur, the knitwear capital of India. It was necessary because as a textile and a dye industry, the coconuts were coming out purple and green on the inside and, you know, these kinds of things. I mean, it was really peculiar. The chief minister was a real character. She was a very famous movie star who had dubious managerial skills and, in fact, was put in jail for them. And after 7 years, she came out of jail, and the first thing that she asked about was, where's my water supply for Tiruppur? Because they had put it on hold when she was jailed. And I was being sort of chastised, let's call it, by the office. How could you put so much money into working in a thing if you weren't going to be able to realize it? And I said, listen, you're going to work in a place. You're going to work in a place like India. You're on their time scale. You're not on your time scale. And if you insist on yours, then frankly, it's almost better that you don't do it, because you're going to go in, you're going to do it for them. They're not going to buy into it. They're not going to have skills for the operation and maintenance of the service that you're providing. And so therefore, what you really need to do is you need to work at a pace that is legitimate. In the book, it describes my first experience with time in Latin America. I am, you know, type A personality. You're running around. You have three appointments in these very distant communities up in the mountains. You're in the Andes, and this is far away, and you're walking in and out of these places. You get off a bus, and you go for 5 hours in. And I'm coming down the hill out of these one to catch the only bus that's going to run to get to the next village, and I'm shouting at the top of my voice, stop, pare, pare, and because I see the bus coming, and it blows by the stop, and I'm not there, and I'm down there, and I'm muttering to myself, and there's these two campesinos, these guys from the neighborhood, and they're looking at me like, what's the matter with you? And I said, listen, I just missed my bus. He says, tome una fría. I said, have a cold one. And so we sat down, and we had some beers. And then the next bus came, and I missed that bus too, because I was having a great time. And that was how I was able, really, to understand that, you know, you move as you can. You play the hand you're dealt. You really are thinking about that.
And tomar una fría, having a cold beer with those guys, is actually part of the development process.
Exactly.
Essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that for me was yet another of the examples of how it was up to me to really understand and to listen to what the context It was all, it's all about context, that if you impose yours from the outside, you'll never get anywhere. If you're able to see, understand where the people are and what needs to be done and how you move from there to a new position.
And what their innate knowledge and intelligence is, which is
absolutely.
Also a huge part of it.
Absolutely. We did some really interesting mapping exercises after the tsunami in some of the villages. And people were saying, oh, there's no information base. How are we going to propose and do anything? I said, well, let's do some community mapping. As we sat down with these different communities, oh, we don't have the proper maps. No, we're going to draw. We're going to hand draw the map. And so we took out these great huge sheets of paper, and we handed out some crayons and some pencils and whatnot. And I said, okay, you work together, community, and you create your map, and you put on the map those people who are most vulnerable, where the floods are, other kinds of issues that you would like to highlight, so that when you are able to create this new approach and this new strategy for sustainability and resilience, we have a baseline to be able to operate from. You would be shocked at the amount of information that poured out of the people. And I said, how do you, well, I mean, what happens is nobody ever asks us. Nobody ever asks us. Right. And so here they have this opportunity and they're able to comply. They really do know their own environment. They do know what needs to be done. And they just need that support to be able to help them accomplish it.
Earl Kessler is author of Letters from Alfonso, Learning to Listen. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.